for the period 1913 to 1948. The top decile claimed as much as 45 to 50% of national income in the 1910s to 1920s, before dropping to 30 to 35% by the end of the 1940s. Inequality then stabilized at that level from 1950 to 1970. We subsequently see a rapid rise in inequality in the 1980s, until by 2000 we have returned to a level on the order of 45 to 50% of national income. The magnitude of the change is impressive. It is natural to ask how far such a trend might continue. I will show that this spectacular increase in inequality largely reflects an unprecedented explosion of very elevated incomes from labor, a veritable separation of the top managers of large firms from the rest of the population. One possible explanation of this is that the skills and productivity of these top managers rose suddenly in relation to those of other workers. Another explanation, which to me seems more plausible and turns out to be much more consistent with the evidence, is that these top managers by and large have the power to set their own remuneration, in some cases without limit, and in many cases without any clear relation to their individual productivity, which in any case is very difficult to estimate in a large organization. This phenomenon is seen mainly in the United States, and to a lesser degree in Britain, and it may be possible to explain it in terms of the history of social and fiscal norms in those two countries over the past century. The tendency is less marked in other wealthy countries, such as Japan, Germany, France, and other continental European states, but the trend is in the same direction. To expect that the phenomenon will attain the same proportions elsewhere, as it has done in the United States, would be risky until we have subjected it to a full analysis, which, unfortunately, is not that simple, given the limits of the available data. The fundamental force for divergence. R is greater than G. The second pattern, represented in PDF Figure 1.2, reflects a divergence mechanism that is in some ways simpler and more transparent, and no doubt exerts greater influence on the long-run evolution of the wealth distribution. PDF Figure 1.2 shows the total value of private wealth in real estate, financial assets, and professional capital, net of debt, in Britain, France, and Germany, expressed in years of national income for the period 1870 to 2010. Note, first of all, the very high level of private wealth in Europe in the late 19th century. The total amount of private wealth hovered around 6 or 7 years of national income, which is a lot. It then fell sharply in response to the shocks of the period 1914 to 1945. The capital income ratio decreased to just 2 or 3. We then observe a steady rise from 1950 on, a rise so sharp that private fortunes in the early 21st century seem to be on the verge of returning to 5 or 6 years of national income in both Britain and France. Private wealth in Germany, which started at a lower level, remains lower, but the upward trend is just as clear. This U-shaped curve reflects an absolutely crucial transformation, which will figure largely in this study. In particular, I will show that the return of high capital income ratios over the past few decades can be explained in large part by the return to a regime of relatively slow growth. In slowly growing economies, past wealth naturally takes on disproportionate importance because it takes only a small flow of new savings to increase the stock of wealth steadily and substantially. If, moreover, the rate of return on capital remains significantly above the growth rate for an extended period of time, which is more likely when the growth rate is low, though not automatic, then the risk of divergence in the distribution of wealth is very high. This fundamental inequality, which I will write as R is greater than G, where R stands for the average annual rate of return on capital, including profits, dividends, interest, rents, and other income from capital, expressed as a percentage of its total value, and G stands for the rate of growth of the economy, that is, the annual increase in income or output, will play a crucial role in this book. In a sense, it sums up the overall logic of my conclusions. When the rate of return on capital significantly exceeds the growth rate of the economy, as it did through much of history until the 19th century, and as is likely to be the case again in the 21st century, then it logically follows that inherited wealth grows faster than output and income. People with inherited wealth need save only a portion of their income from capital to see that capital grow more quickly than the economy as a whole. Under such conditions, it is almost inevitable that inherited wealth will dominate wealth amassed from a lifetime's labor by a wide margin, and the concentration of capital will attain extremely high levels, levels potentially incompatible with the meritocratic values and principles of social justice fundamental to modern democratic societies. What is more, this basic force for divergence can be reinforced by other mechanisms. For instance, the savings rate may increase sharply with wealth. Or, even more important, the average effective rate of return on capital may be higher when the individual's initial capital endowment is higher, as appears to be increasingly common. The fact that the return on capital is unpredictable and arbitrary, so that wealth can be enhanced in a variety of ways, also poses a challenge to the meritocratic model. Finally, all of these factors can be aggravated by the Ricardian scarcity principle. The high price of real estate or petroleum may contribute to structural divergence. To sum up what has been said thus far, the process by which wealth is accumulated and distributed contains powerful forces pushing toward divergence, or at any rate toward an extremely high level of inequality. Forces of convergence also exist, and in certain countries at certain times these may prevail. But the forces of divergence can at any point regain the upper hand, as seems to be happening now, at the beginning of the 21st century. The likely decrease in the rate of growth of both the population and the economy in coming decades makes this trend all the more worrisome. My conclusions are less apocalyptic than those implied by Marx's principle of infinite accumulation and perpetual divergence, since Marx's theory implicitly relies on a strict assumption of zero productivity growth over the long run. In the model I propose, divergence is not perpetual and is only one of several possible future directions for the distribution of wealth. But the possibilities are not heartening. Specifically, it is important to note that the fundamental R is greater than G inequality, the main force of divergence in my theory, has nothing to do with any market imperfection. Quite the contrary, the more perfect the capital market, in the economist's sense, the more likely R is to be greater than G. It is possible to imagine public institutions and policies that would counter the effects of this implacable logic. For instance, a progressive global tax on capital. But establishing such institutions and policies would require a considerable degree of international coordination. It is unfortunately likely that actual responses to the problem, including various nationalist responses, will in practice be far more modest and less effective. The geographical and historical boundaries of this study. What will the geographical and historical boundaries of this study be? To the extent possible, I will explore the dynamics of the distribution of wealth between and within countries around the world since the 18th century. However, the limitations of the available data will often make it necessary to narrow the scope of inquiry rather severely. In regard to the between-country distribution of output and income, the subject of the first part of the book, a global approach is possible from 1700 on, thanks in particular to the national accounts data compiled by Angus Madison. When it comes to studying the capital-income ratio and capital-labor split in Part 2, the absence of adequate historical data will force me to focus primarily on the wealthy countries and proceed by extrapolation to poor and emerging countries. The examination of the evolution of inequalities of income and wealth, the subject of Part 3, will also be narrowly constrained by the limitations of the available sources. I try to include as many poor and emergent countries as possible, using data from the WTID, which aims to cover 5 continents as thoroughly as possible. Nevertheless, the long-term trends are far better documented in the rich countries. To put it plainly, this book relies primarily on the historical experience of the leading developed countries, the United States, Japan, Germany, France, and Great Britain. The British and French cases turn out to be particularly significant because the most complete long-run historical sources pertain to these two countries. We have multiple estimates of both the magnitude and structure of national wealth for Britain and France as far back as the early 18th century. These two countries were also the leading colonial and financial powers in the 19th and early 20th centuries. It is therefore clearly important to study them if we wish to understand the dynamics of the global distribution of wealth since the Industrial Revolution. In particular, their history is indispensable for studying what has been called the first globalization of finance and trade, 1870 to 1914, a period that is in many ways similar to the second globalization, which has been underway since the 1970s. The period of the first globalization is as fascinating as it was prodigiously inegalitarian. It saw the invention of the electric light, as well as the heyday of the ocean liner. The Titanic sailed in 1912. The advent of film and radio, and the rise of the automobile and international investment. Note, for example, that it was not until the coming of the 21st century that the wealthy countries regained the same level of stock market capitalization relative to GDP that Paris and London achieved in the early 1900s. This comparison is quite instructive for understanding today's world. Some readers will no doubt be surprised that I accord special importance to the study of the French case and may suspect me of nationalism. I should therefore justify my decision. One reason for my choice has to do with sources. The French Revolution did not create a just or ideal society, but it did make it possible to observe the structure of wealth in unprecedented detail. The system established in the 1790s for recording wealth in land, buildings, and financial assets was astonishingly modern and comprehensive for its time. The Revolution is the reason why French estate records are probably the richest in the world over the long run. My second reason is that because France was the first country to experience the demographic transition, it is in some respects a good place to observe what awaits the rest of the planet. Although the country's population has increased over the past 2 centuries, the rate of increase has been relatively low. The population of the country was roughly 30 million at the time of the revolution, and it is slightly more than 60 million today. It is the same country with a population whose order of magnitude has not changed. By contrast, the population of the United States at the time of the Declaration of Independence was barely 3 million. By 1900, it was 100 million, and today it is above 300 million. When a country goes from a population of 3 million to a population of 300 million, to say nothing of the radical increase in territory owing to westward expansion in the 19th century, it is clearly no longer the same country. The dynamics and structure of inequality look very different in a country whose population increases by a factor of 100 compared with a country whose population merely doubles. In particular, the inheritance factor is much less important in the former than in the latter. It has been the demographic growth of the New World that has ensured that inherited wealth has always played a smaller role in the United States than in Europe. This factor also explains why the structure of inequality in the United States has always been so peculiar, and the same can be said of U.S. representations of inequality and social class. But it also suggests that the U.S. case is in some sense not generalizable, because it is unlikely that the population of the world will increase 100-fold over the next 2 centuries, and that the French case is more typical and more pertinent for understanding the future. I am convinced that detailed analysis of the French case and more generally of the various historical trajectories observed in other developed countries in Europe, Japan, North America, and Oceania, can tell us a great deal about the future dynamics of global wealth, including such emergent economies as China, Brazil, and India, where demographic and economic growth will undoubtedly slow in the future, as they have done already. Finally, the French case is interesting because the French Revolution, the bourgeois revolution par excellence, quickly established an ideal of legal equality in relation to the market. It is interesting to look at how this ideal affected the dynamics of wealth distribution. Although the English Revolution of 1688 established modern parliamentarism, it left standing a royal dynasty, primogeniture on landed estates, ended only in the 1920s, and political privileges for the hereditary nobility. Reform of the House of Lords is still under discussion, a bit late in the day. Although the American Revolution established the Republican principle, it allowed slavery to continue for nearly a century, and legal racial discrimination for nearly two centuries. The race question still has a disproportionate influence on the social question in the United States today. In a way, the French Revolution of 1789 was more ambitious. It abolished all legal privileges and sought to create a political and social order based entirely on equality of rights and opportunities. The civil code guaranteed absolute equality before the laws of property as well as freedom of contract, for men at any rate. In the late 19th century, conservative French economists, such as Paul Leroy Beaulieu, often used this argument to explain why Republican France, a nation of small property owners, made egalitarian by the Revolution, had no need of a progressive or confiscatory income tax or estate tax, in contrast to aristocratic and monarchical Britain. The data show, however, that the concentration of wealth was as large at that time in France as in Britain, which clearly demonstrates that equality of rights in the marketplace cannot ensure equality of rights tout court. Here again, the French experience is quite relevant to today's world, where many commentators continue to believe, as Leroy Beaulieu did a little more than a century ago, that ever more fully guaranteed property rights, ever freer markets, and ever purer and more perfect competition are enough to ensure a just, prosperous, and harmonious society. Unfortunately, the task is more complex. The Theoretical and Conceptual Framework. Before proceeding, it may be useful to say a little more about the theoretical and conceptual framework of this research, as well as the intellectual itinerary that led me to write this book. I belong to a generation that turned 18 in 1989, which was not only the bicentennial of the French Revolution, but also the year the Berlin Wall fell. I belong to a generation that came of age listening to news of the collapse of the communist dictatorships and never felt the slightest affection or nostalgia for those regimes or for the Soviet Union. I was vaccinated for life against the conventional but lazy rhetoric of anti-capitalism, some of which simply ignored the historic failure of communism, and much of which turned its back on the intellectual means necessary to push beyond it. I have no interest in denouncing inequality or capitalism per se, especially since social inequalities are not in themselves a problem as long as they are justified, that is, founded only upon common utility, as Article 1 of the 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen proclaims. Although this definition of social justice is imprecise but seductive, it is rooted in history. Let us accept it for now. I will return to this point later on. By contrast, I am interested in contributing, however modestly, to the debate about the best way to organize society and the most appropriate institutions and policies to achieve a just social order. Furthermore, I would like to see justice achieved effectively and efficiently under the rule of law, which should apply equally to all and derive from universally understood statutes subject to democratic debate. I should perhaps add that I experienced the American dream at the age of 22 when I was hired by a university near Boston just after finishing my doctorate. This experience proved to be decisive in more ways than one. It was the first time I had set foot in the United States, and it felt good to have my work recognized so quickly. Here was a country that knew how to attract immigrants when it wanted to. Yet I also realized quite soon that I wanted to return to France and Europe, which I did when I was 25. Since then, I have not left Paris, except for a few brief trips. One important reason for my choice has a direct bearing on this book. I did not find the work of U.S. economists entirely convincing. To be sure, they were all very intelligent, and I still have many friends from that period of my life. But something strange happened. I was only too aware of the fact that I knew nothing at all about the world's economic problems. My thesis consisted of several relatively abstract mathematical theorems. Yet, the profession liked my work. I quickly realized that there had been no significant effort to collect historical data on the dynamics of inequality since Kuznets. Yet, the profession continued to churn out purely theoretical results, without even knowing what facts needed to be explained. And it expected me to do the same. When I returned to France, I set out to collect the missing data. To put it bluntly, the discipline of economics has yet to get over its childish passion for mathematics, and for purely theoretical and often highly ideological speculation, at the expense of historical research and collaboration with the other social sciences. Economists are all too often preoccupied with petty mathematical problems of interest only to themselves. This obsession with mathematics is an easy way of acquiring the appearance of scientificity without having to answer the far more complex questions posed by the world we live in. There is one great advantage to being an academic economist in France. Here, economists are not highly respected in the academic and intellectual world, or by political and financial elites. Hence, they must set aside their contempt for other disciplines and their absurd claim to greater scientific legitimacy, despite the fact that they know almost nothing about anything. This, in any case, is the charm of the discipline and of the social sciences in general. One starts from square one, so that there is some hope of making major progress. In France, I believe, economists are slightly more interested in persuading historians and sociologists, as well as people outside the academic world, that what they are doing is interesting, although they are not always successful. My dream when I was teaching in Boston was to teach at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, whose faculty has included such leading lights as Lucien Febvre, Fernand Braudel, Claude Levi-Strauss, Pierre Bourdieu, Françoise Héritier, and Maurice Godelier, to name a few. Dare I admit this, at the risk of seeming chauvinistic in my view of the social sciences? I probably admire these scholars more than Robert Solow, or even Simon Kuznets, even though I regret the fact that the social sciences have largely lost interest in the distribution of wealth and questions of social class since the 1970s. Before that, statistics about income, wages, prices, and wealth played an important part in historical and sociological research. In any case, I hope that both professional social scientists and amateurs of all fields will find something of interest in this book, starting with those who claim to know nothing about economics, but who nevertheless have very strong opinions about inequality of income and wealth, as is only natural. The truth is that economics should never have sought to divorce itself from the other social sciences, and can advance only in conjunction with them. The social sciences collectively know too little to waste time on foolish disciplinary squabbles. If we are to progress in our understanding of the historical dynamics of the wealth distribution and the structure of social classes, we must obviously take a pragmatic approach and avail ourselves of the methods of historians, sociologists, and political scientists, as well as economists. We must start with fundamental questions and try to answer them. Disciplinary disputes and turf wars are of little or no importance. In my mind, this book is as much a work of history as of economics. As I explained earlier, I began this work by collecting sources and establishing historical time series pertaining to the distribution of income and wealth. As the book proceeds, I sometimes appeal to theory and to abstract models and concepts, but I try to do so sparingly and only to the extent that theory enhances our understanding of the changes we observe. For example, income, capital, the economic growth rate, and the rate of return on capital are abstract concepts, theoretical constructs, rather than mathematical certainties. Yet, I will show that these concepts allow us to analyze historical reality in interesting ways, provided that we remain clear-eyed and critical about the limited precision with which we can measure these things. I will also use a few equations, such as alpha equals R times beta, which says that the share of capital in national income is equal to the product of the return on capital and the capital income ratio, or beta equals S divided by G, which says that the capital income ratio is equal in the long run to the savings rate divided by the growth rate. I ask readers not well versed in mathematics to be patient and not immediately close the book. These are elementary equations, which can be explained in a simple, intuitive way and can be understood without any specialized technical knowledge. Above all, I try to show that this minimal theoretical framework is sufficient to give a clear account of what everyone will recognize as important historical developments. Outline of the book. The remainder of the book consists of 16 chapters divided into 4 parts. Part 1, titled Income and Capital, contains 2 chapters and introduces basic ideas that are used repeatedly in the remainder of the book. Specifically, Chapter 1 presents the concepts of national income, capital, and the capital-income ratio, and then describes in broad brushstrokes how the global distribution of income and output has evolved. Chapter 2 gives a more detailed analysis of how the growth rates of population and output have evolved since the Industrial Revolution. This first part of the book contains nothing really new, and the reader familiar with these ideas and with the history of global growth since the 18th century may wish to skip directly to Part 2. The purpose of Part 2, titled The Dynamics of the Capital-Income Ratio, which consists of 4 chapters, is to examine the prospects for the long-run evolution of the capital-income ratio and the global division of national income between labor and capital in the 21st century. Chapter 3 looks at the metamorphoses of capital since the 18th century, starting with the British and French cases, about which we possess the most data over the long run. Chapter 4 introduces the German and U.S. cases. Chapters 5 and 6 extend the geographical range of the analysis to the entire planet, insofar as the sources allow, and seek to draw the lessons from all of these historical experiences that can enable us to anticipate the possible evolution of the capital-income ratio and the relative shares of capital and labor in the decades to come. Part 3, titled The Structure of Inequality, consists of 6 chapters. Chapter 7 familiarizes the reader with the orders of magnitude of inequality attained in practice by the distribution of income from labor on the one hand and of capital ownership and income from capital on the other. Chapter 8 then analyzes the historical dynamics of these inequalities, starting with a comparison of France and the United States. Chapters 9 and 10 extend the analysis to all the countries for which we have historical data, in the WTID, looking separately at inequalities related to labor and capital, respectively. Chapter 11 studies the changing importance of inherited wealth over the long run. Finally, Chapter 12 looks at the prospects for the global distribution of wealth over the first few decades of the 21st century. The purpose of Part 4, titled Regulating Capital in the 21st Century, and consisting of 4 chapters, is to draw normative and policy lessons from the previous 3 parts, whose purpose is primarily to establish the facts and understand the reasons for the observed changes. Chapter 13 examines what a social state suited to present conditions might look like. Chapter 14 proposes a rethinking of the progressive income tax based on past experience and recent trends. Chapter 15 describes what a progressive tax on capital adapted to 21st century conditions might look like and compares this idealized tool to other types of regulation that might emerge from the political process, ranging from a wealth tax in Europe to capital controls in China, immigration reform in the United States, and revival of protectionism in many countries. Chapter 16 deals with the pressing question of public debt and the related issue of the optimal accumulation of public capital at a time when natural capital may be deteriorating. One final word. It would have been quite presumptuous in 1913 to publish a book called Capital in the 20th Century. I beg the reader's indulgence for giving the title Capital in the 21st Century to this book, which appeared in French in 2013 and in English in 2014. I am only too well aware of my total inability to predict what form capital will take in 2063 or 2113. As I already noted, and as I will frequently show in what follows, the history of income and wealth is always deeply political, chaotic, and unpredictable. How this history plays out depends on how societies view inequalities and what kinds of policies and institutions they adopt to measure and transform them. No one can foresee how these things will change in the decades to come. The lessons of history are nevertheless useful because they help us to see a little more clearly what kinds of choices we will face in the coming century and what sorts of dynamics will be at work. The sole purpose of the book, which logically speaking should have been entitled Capital at the Dawn of the 21st Century, is to draw from the past a few modest keys to the future. Since history always invents its own pathways, the actual usefulness of these lessons from the past remains to be seen. I offer them to readers without presuming to know their full import. Part 1. Income and Capital. Chapter 1. Income and Output. On August 16, 2012, the South African police intervened in a labor conflict between workers at the Marikana platinum mine near Johannesburg and the mine's owners, the stockholders of Lonmin Inc., based in London. Police fired on the strikers with live ammunition. 34 miners were killed. As often in such strikes, the conflict primarily concerned wages. The miners had asked for a doubling of their wage, from 500 to 1,000 euros a month. After the tragic loss of life, the company finally proposed a monthly raise of 75 euros. This episode reminds us, if we needed reminding, that the question of what share of output should go to wages and what share to profits. In other words, how should the income from production be divided between labor and capital, has always been at the heart of distributional conflict. In traditional societies, the basis of social inequality and most common cause of rebellion was the conflict of interest between landlord and peasant, between those who owned land and those who cultivated it with their labor, those who received land rents and those who paid them. The Industrial Revolution exacerbated the conflict between capital and labor, perhaps because production became more capital-intensive than in the past, making use of machinery and exploiting natural resources more than ever before, and perhaps, too, because hopes for a more equitable distribution of income and a more democratic social order were dashed. I will come back to this point. The Marikana tragedy calls to mind earlier instances of violence. At Haymarket Square in Chicago on May 1, 1886, and then at Fourmi in northern France on May 1, 1891, police fired on workers striking for higher wages. Does this kind of violent clash between labor and capital belong to the past, or will it be an integral part of 21st century history? The first two parts of this book focus on the respective shares of global income going to labor and capital, and on how those shares have changed since the 18th century. I will temporarily set aside the issue of income inequality between workers, for example, between an ordinary worker, an engineer, and a plant manager, and between capitalists, for example, between small, medium, and large stockholders, or landlords, until Part 3. Clearly, each of these two dimensions of the distribution of wealth, the factorial distribution, in which labor and capital are treated as factors of production, viewed in the abstract as homogeneous entities, and the individual distribution, which takes account of inequalities of income from labor and capital at the individual level, is in practice fundamentally important. It is impossible to achieve a satisfactory understanding of the distributional problem without analyzing both. In any case, the Marikana miners were striking not only against what they took to be Lonmin's excessive profits, but also against the apparently fabulous salary awarded to the mine's manager and the difference between his compensation and theirs. Indeed, if capital ownership were equally distributed, and each worker received an equal share of profits in addition to his or her wages, virtually no one would be interested in the division of earnings between profits and wages. If the capital-labor split gives rise to so many conflicts, it is due first and foremost to the extreme concentration of the ownership of capital. Inequality of wealth, and of the consequent income from capital, is in fact always much greater than inequality of income from labor. I will analyze this phenomenon and its causes in Part 3. For now, I will take the inequality of income from labor and capital as given and focus on the global division of national income between capital and labor. To be clear, my purpose here is not to plead the case of workers against owners, but rather to gain as clear as possible a view of reality. Symbolically, the inequality of capital and labor is an issue that arouses strong emotions. It clashes with widely held ideas of what is and is not just, and it is hardly surprising if this sometimes leads to physical violence. For those who own nothing but their labor power, and who often live in humble conditions, not to say wretched conditions, in the case of 18th century peasants, or the Marikana miners, it is difficult to accept that the owners of capital, some of whom have inherited at least part of their wealth, are able to appropriate so much of the wealth produced by their labor. Capital's share can be quite large, often as much as one quarter of total output, and sometimes as high as one half in capital-intensive sectors, such as mining, or even more where local monopolies allow the owners of capital to demand an even larger share. Of course, everyone can also understand that if all the company's earnings from its output went to paying wages and nothing to profits, it would probably be difficult to attract the capital needed to finance new investments, at least as our economies are currently organized. To be sure, one can imagine other forms of organization. Furthermore, it is not necessarily just to deny any remuneration to those who choose to save more than others, assuming, of course, that differences in saving are an important reason for the inequality of wealth. Bear in mind, too, that a portion of what is called the income of capital may be remuneration for entrepreneurial labor, and this should no doubt be treated as we treat other forms of labor. This classic argument deserves closer scrutiny. Taking all these elements into account, what is the right split between capital and labor? Can we be sure that an economy based on the free market and private property always and everywhere leads to an optimal division, as if by magic? In an ideal society, how would one arrange the division between capital and labor? How should one think about the problem? The capital-labor split in the long run. Not so stable. If this study is to make even modest progress on these questions, and at least clarify the terms of a debate that appears to be endless, it will be useful to begin by establishing some facts as accurately and carefully as possible. What exactly do we know about the evolution of the capital-labor split since the 18th century? For a long time, the idea accepted by most economists, and uncritically repeated in textbooks, was that the relative shares of labor and capital in national income were quite stable over the long run, with the generally accepted figure being two-thirds for labor and one-third for capital. Today, with the advantage of greater historical perspective and newly available data, it is clear that the reality was quite a bit more complex. For one thing, the capital-labor split varied widely over the course of the 20th century. The changes observed in the 19th century, which I touched on in the introduction, an increase in the capital share in the first half of the century, followed by a slight decrease, and then a period of stability, seem mild by comparison. Briefly, the shocks that buffeted the economy in the period 1914 to 1945, World War I, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the Great Depression, World War II, and the consequent advent of new regulatory and tax policies, along with controls on capital, reduced capital's share of income to historically low levels in the 1950s. Very soon, however, capital began to reconstitute itself. The growth of capital's share accelerated with the victories of Margaret Thatcher in England in 1979 and Ronald Reagan in the United States in 1980, marking the beginning of a conservative revolution. Then came the collapse of the Soviet bloc in 1989, followed by financial globalization and deregulation in the 1990s. All of these events marked a political turn in the opposite direction from that observed in the first half of the 20th century. By 2010, and despite the crisis that began in 2007 to 2008, capital was prospering as it had not done since 1913. Not all of the consequences of capital's renewed prosperity were negative. To some extent, it was a natural and desirable development. But it has changed the way we look at the capital-labor split since the beginning of the 21st century, as well as our view of changes likely to occur in the decades to come. Furthermore, if we look beyond the 20th century and adopt a very long-term view, the idea of a stable capital-labor split must somehow deal with the fact that the nature of capital itself has changed radically, from land and other real estate in the 18th century to industrial and financial capital in the 21st century. There is also the idea, widespread among economists, that modern economic growth depends largely on the rise of human capital. At first glance, this would seem to imply that labor should claim a growing share of national income. And one does indeed find that there may be a tendency for labor's share to increase over the very long run. But the gains are relatively modest. Capital's share, excluding human capital, in the early decades of the 21st century is only slightly smaller than it was at the beginning of the 19th century. The importance of capital in the wealthy countries today is primarily due to a slowing of both demographic growth and productivity growth, coupled with political regimes that objectively favor private capital. The most fruitful way to understand these changes is to analyze the evolution of the capital-income ratio, that is, the ratio of the total stock of capital to the annual flow of income, rather than focus exclusively on the capital-labor split, that is, the share of income going to capital and labor, respectively. In the past, scholars have mainly studied the latter, largely owing to the lack of adequate data to do anything else. Before presenting my results in detail, it is best to proceed by stages. The purpose of Part 1 of this book is to introduce certain basic notions. In the remainder of this chapter, I will begin by presenting the concepts of domestic product and national income, capital and labor, and the capital-income ratio. Then, I will look at how the global distribution of income has changed since the Industrial Revolution. In Chapter 2, I will analyze the general evolution of growth rates over time. This will play a central role in the subsequent analysis. With these preliminaries out of the way, Part 2 takes up the dynamics of the capital-income ratio and the capital-labor split, once again proceeding by stages. Chapter 3 will look at changes in the composition of capital and the capital-income ratio since the 18th century, beginning with Britain and France, about which we have the best long-run data. Chapter 4 introduces the German case, and above all, looks at the United States, which serves as a useful complement to the European prism. Finally, chapters 5 and 6 attempt to extend the analysis to all the rich countries of the world, and insofar as possible, to the entire planet. I also attempt to draw conclusions relevant to the global dynamics of the capital-income ratio and capital-labor split in the 21st century. The idea of national income. It will be useful to begin with the concept of national income, to which I will frequently refer in what follows. National income is defined as the sum of all income available to the residents of a given country in a given year, regardless of the legal classification of that income. National income is closely related to the idea of GDP, which comes up often in public debate. There are, however, two important differences between GDP and national income. GDP measures the total of goods and services produced in a given year within the borders of a given country. In order to calculate national income, one must first subtract from GDP the depreciation of the capital that made this production possible. In other words, one must deduct wear and tear on buildings, infrastructure, machinery, vehicles, computers, and other items during the year in question. This depreciation is substantial, today on the order of 10% of GDP in most countries, and it does not correspond to anyone's income. Before wages are distributed to workers or dividends to stockholders, and before genuinely new investments are made, worn-out capital must be replaced or repaired. If this is not done, wealth is lost, resulting in negative income for the owners. When depreciation is subtracted from GDP, one obtains the net domestic product, which I will refer to more simply as domestic output or domestic production, which is typically 90% of GDP. Then one must add net income received from abroad, or subtract net income paid to foreigners, depending on each country's situation. For example, a country whose firms and other capital assets are owned by foreigners may well have a high domestic product, but a much lower national income, once profits and rents flowing abroad are deducted from the total. Conversely, a country that owns a large portion of the capital of other countries may enjoy a national income much higher than its domestic product. Later, I will give examples of both of these situations, drawn from the history of capitalism as well as from today's world. I should say at once that this type of international inequality can give rise to great political tension. It is not an insignificant thing when one country works for another and pays out a substantial share of its output as dividends and rent to foreigners over a long period of time. In many cases, such a system can survive, to a point, only if sustained by relations of political domination, as was the case in the colonial era, when Europe effectively owned much of the rest of the world. A key question of this research is the following. Under what conditions is this type of situation likely to recur in the 21st century, possibly in some novel geographic configuration? For example, Europe, rather than being the owner, may find itself owned. Such fears are currently widespread in the old world. Perhaps too widespread. We shall see. At this stage, suffice it to say that most countries, whether wealthy or emergent, are currently in much more balanced situations than one sometimes imagines. In France, as in the United States, Germany, as well as Great Britain, China, as well as Brazil, and Japan, as well as Italy, national income is within 1 or 2% of domestic product. In all these countries, in other words, the inflow of profits, interest, dividends, rent, and so on, is more or less balanced by a comparable outflow. In wealthy countries, net income from abroad is generally slightly positive. To a first approximation, the residents of these countries own as much in foreign real estate and financial instruments as foreigners own of theirs. Contrary to a tenacious myth, France is not owned by California pension funds or the Bank of China any more than the United States belongs to Japanese and German investors. The fear of getting into such a predicament is so strong today that fantasy often outstrips reality. The reality is that inequality with respect to capital is a far greater domestic issue than it is an international one. Inequality in the ownership of capital brings the rich and poor within each country into conflict with one another, far more than it pits one country against another. This has not always been the case, however, and it is perfectly legitimate to ask whether our future may not look more like our past, particularly since certain countries, Japan, Germany, the oil-exporting countries, and to a lesser degree China, have in recent years accumulated substantial claims on the rest of the world, though by no means as large as the record claims of the colonial era. Furthermore, the very substantial increase in cross-ownership, in which various countries own substantial shares of one another, can give rise to a legitimate sense of dispossession, even when net asset positions are close to zero. To sum up, a country's national income may be greater or smaller than its domestic product, depending on whether net income from abroad is positive or negative. National income equals domestic output plus net income from abroad. At the global level, income received from abroad and paid abroad must balance, so that income is by definition equal to output. Global income equals global output. This equality between two annual flows, income and output, is an accounting identity, yet it reflects an important reality. In any given year, it is impossible for total income to exceed the amount of new wealth that is produced. Globally speaking, a single country may of course borrow from abroad. Conversely, all production must be distributed as income in one form or another, to either labor or capital, whether as wages, salaries, honoraria, bonuses, and so on. That is, as payments to workers and others who contributed labor to the process of production, or else as profits, dividends, interest, rents, royalties, and so on. That is, as payments to the owners of capital used in the process of production. What is capital? To recapitulate, regardless of whether we are looking at the accounts of a company, a nation, or the global economy, the associated output and income can be decomposed as the sum of income to capital and income to labor. National income equals capital income plus labor income. But what is capital? What are its limits? What forms does it take? How has its composition changed over time? This question, central to this investigation, will be examined in greater detail in subsequent chapters. For now, it will suffice to make the following points. First, throughout this book, when I speak of capital, without further qualification, I always exclude what economists often call, unfortunately, to my mind, human capital, which consists of an individual's labor power, skills, training, and abilities. In this book, capital is defined as the sum total of non-human assets that can be owned and exchanged on some market. Capital includes all forms of real property, including residential real estate, as well as financial and professional capital, plants, infrastructure, machinery, patents, and so on, used by firms and government agencies. There are many reasons for excluding human capital from our definition of capital. The most obvious is that human capital cannot be owned by another person or traded on a market, not permanently at any rate. This is a key difference from other forms of capital. One can, of course, put one's labor services up for hire under a labor contract of some sort. In all modern legal systems, however, such an arrangement has to be limited in both time and scope. In slave societies, of course, this is obviously not true. There, a slaveholder can fully and completely own the human capital of another person, and even of that person's offspring. In such societies, slaves can be bought and sold on the market and conveyed by inheritance, and it is common to include slaves in calculating a slaveholder's wealth. I will show how this worked when I examine the composition of private capital in the southern United States before 1865. Leaving such special, and for now historical, cases aside, it makes little sense to attempt to add human and non-human capital. Throughout history, both forms of wealth have played fundamental and complementary roles in economic growth and development, and will continue to do so in the 21st century. But in order to understand the growth process and the inequalities it engenders, we must distinguish carefully between human and non-human capital and treat each one separately. Non-human capital, which in this book I will call simply capital, includes all forms of wealth that individuals, or groups of individuals, can own, and that can be transferred or traded through the market on a permanent basis. In practice, capital can be owned by private individuals, in which case we speak of private capital, or by the government or government agencies, in which case we speak of public capital. There are also intermediate forms of collective property owned by moral persons, that is, entities such as foundations and churches, pursuing specific aims. I will come back to this. The boundary between what private individuals can and cannot own has evolved considerably over time and around the world, as the extreme case of slavery indicates. The same is true of property in the atmosphere, the sea, mountains, historical monuments, and knowledge. Certain private interests would like to own these things, and sometimes they justify this desire on grounds of efficiency rather than mere self-interest. But there is no guarantee that this desire coincides with the general interest. Capital is not an immutable concept. It reflects the state of development and prevailing social relations of each society. Capital and wealth. To simplify the text, I use the words capital and wealth interchangeably, as if they were perfectly synonymous. By some definitions, it would be better to reserve the word capital to describe forms of wealth accumulated by human beings, buildings, machinery, infrastructure, etc., and therefore to exclude land and natural resources, with which humans have been endowed without having to accumulate them. Land would then be a component of wealth, but not of capital. The problem is that it is not always easy to distinguish the value of buildings from the value of the land on which they are built. An even greater difficulty is that it is very hard to gauge the value of virgin land, as humans found it centuries or millennia ago, apart from improvements due to human intervention, such as drainage, irrigation, fertilization, and so on. The same problem arises in connection with natural resources, such as petroleum, gas, rare earth elements, and the like, whose pure value is hard to distinguish from the value added by the investments needed to discover new deposits and prepare them for exploitation. I therefore include all these forms of wealth in capital. Of course, this choice does not eliminate the need to look closely at the origins of wealth, especially the boundary line between accumulation and appropriation. Some definitions of capital hold that the term should apply only to those components of wealth directly employed in the production process. For instance, gold might be counted as part of wealth, but not of capital, because gold is said to be useful only as a store of value. Once again, this limitation strikes me as neither desirable nor practical, because gold can be a factor of production, not only in the manufacture of jewelry, but also in electronics and nanotechnology. Capital, in all its forms, has always played a dual role, as both a store of value and a factor of production. I therefore decided that it was simpler not to impose a rigid distinction between wealth and capital. Similarly, I ruled out the idea of excluding residential real estate from capital on the grounds that it is unproductive, unlike the productive capital used by firms and government, industrial plants, office buildings, machinery, infrastructure, and so on. The truth is that all these forms of wealth are useful and productive and reflect capital's two major economic functions. Residential real estate can be seen as a capital asset that yields housing services, whose value is measured by their rental equivalent. Other capital assets can serve as factors of production for firms and government agencies that produce goods and services, and need plants, offices, machinery, infrastructure, etc., to do so. Each of these two types of capital currently accounts for roughly half the capital stock in the developed countries. To summarize, I define national wealth, or national capital, as the total market value of everything owned by the residents and government of a given country at a given point in time, provided that it can be traded on some market. It consists of the sum total of non-financial assets, land, dwellings, commercial inventory, other buildings, machinery, infrastructure, patents, and other directly owned professional assets, and financial assets, bank accounts, mutual funds, bonds, stocks, financial investments of all kinds, insurance policies, pension funds, etc., less the total amount of financial liabilities, debt. If we look only at the assets and liabilities of private individuals, the result is private wealth or private capital. If we consider assets and liabilities held by the government and other governmental entities, such as towns, social insurance agencies, etc., the result is public wealth or public capital. By definition, national wealth is the sum of these two terms. National wealth equals private wealth plus public wealth. Public wealth in most developed countries is currently insignificant, or even negative, where the public debt exceeds public assets. As I will show, private wealth accounts for nearly all of national wealth almost everywhere. This has not always been the case, however, so it is important to distinguish clearly between the two notions. To be clear, although my concept of capital excludes human capital, which cannot be exchanged on any market in non-slave societies, it is not limited to physical capital, land, buildings, infrastructure, and other material goods. I include immaterial capital, such as patents and other intellectual property, which are counted either as non-financial assets, if individuals hold patents directly, or as financial assets, when an individual owns shares of a corporation that holds patents, as is more commonly the case. More broadly, many forms of immaterial capital are taken into account by way of the stock market capitalization of corporations. For instance, the stock market value of a company often depends on its reputation and trademarks, its information systems and modes of organization, its investments, whether material or immaterial, for the purpose of making its products and services more visible and attractive, and so on. All of this is reflected in the price of common stock and other corporate financial assets, and therefore in national wealth. To be sure, the price that the financial markets sets on a company's or even a sector's immaterial capital at any given moment is largely arbitrary and uncertain. We see this in the collapse of the internet bubble in 2000, in the financial crisis that began in 2007 to 2008, and more generally in the enormous volatility of the stock market. The important fact to note for now is that this is a characteristic of all forms of capital, not just immaterial capital. Whether we are speaking of a building or a company, a manufacturing firm or a service firm, it is always very difficult to set a price on capital. Yet, as I will show, total national wealth, that is, the wealth of a country as a whole and not of any particular type of asset, obeys certain laws and conforms to certain regular patterns. One further point, total national wealth can always be broken down into domestic capital and foreign capital. National wealth equals national capital equals domestic capital plus net foreign capital. Domestic capital is the value of the capital stock, buildings, firms, etc., located within the borders of the country in question. Net foreign capital, or net foreign assets, measures the country's position vis-à-vis the rest of the world. More specifically, it is the difference between assets owned by the country's citizens in the rest of the world and assets of the country owned by citizens of other countries. On the eve of World War I, Britain and France both enjoyed significant net positive asset positions vis-à-vis the rest of the world. One characteristic of the financial globalization that has taken place since the 1980s is that many countries have more or less balanced net asset positions, but those positions are quite large in absolute terms. In other words, many countries have large capital stakes in other countries, but those other countries also have stakes in the country in question, and the two positions are more or less equal, so that net foreign capital is close to zero. Globally, of course, all the net positions must add up to zero, so that total global wealth equals the domestic capital of the planet as a whole. The capital-income ratio. Now that income and capital have been defined, I can move on to the first basic law tying these two ideas together. I begin by defining the capital-income ratio. Income is a flow. It corresponds to the quantity of goods produced and distributed in a given period, which we generally take to be a year. Capital is a stock. It corresponds to the total wealth owned at a given point in time. This stock comes from the wealth appropriated or accumulated in all prior years combined. The most natural and useful way to measure the capital stock in a particular country is to divide that stock by the annual flow of income. This gives us the capital income ratio, which I denote by the Greek letter beta. For example, if a country's total capital stock is the equivalent of 6 years of national income, we write beta equals 6, or beta equals 600%. In the developed countries today, the capital income ratio generally varies between 5 and 6, and the capital stock consists almost entirely of private capital. In France and Britain, Germany and Italy, the United States and Japan, national income was roughly 30,000 to 35,000 euros per capita in 2010, whereas total private wealth, net of debt, was typically on the order of 150,000 to 200,000 euros per capita, or 5 to 6 times annual national income. There are interesting variations both within Europe and around the world. For instance, beta is greater than 6 in Japan and Italy, and less than 5 in the United States and Germany. Public wealth is just barely positive in some countries, and slightly negative in others. And so on. I examine all this in detail in the next few chapters. At this point, it is enough to keep these orders of magnitude in mind in order to make the ideas as concrete as possible. The fact that national income in the wealthy countries of the world in 2010 was on the order of 30,000 euros per capita per annum, or 2,500 euros per month, obviously does not mean that everyone earns that amount. Like all averages, this average income figure hides enormous disparities. In practice, many people earn much less than 2,500 euros a month, while others earn dozens of times that much. Income disparities are partly the result of unequal pay for work and partly of much larger inequalities in income from capital, which are themselves a consequence of the extreme concentration of wealth.